Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome back to TF3.
You're going to love it. It's football.
Chris, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good evening.
Good night.
Good morning.
And that other voice is Nick Morales. Nick.
Lawrence, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, we've got a lot to talk about from the international break. We will talk about domestic football very, very soon. But first of all, it's England. It's Defoe. It's Vardy. It's exciting, isn't it, Nick?
Yeah, I guess it is in some cases. I mean, the inclusion of Jermaine Defoe is an interesting one into a squad that he'll be 36 when the World Cup rolls around. So it's an interesting inclusion and one that sort of makes you question the decision as to where the squad is going. But
what do you think the logic is behind including a 35-year-old Jermaine Defoe?
I think as many people will claim, it's all about that experience and bringing someone like Jermaine Defoe into the squad. But I think it might send a message that, you know, as long as you're doing well and as long as you have a possibility of fitting into the idea that Gareth Southgate wants to put out onto the pitch, that you have a chance in getting into the squad.
But did it work?
For now, it does, as opposed to, I think you're honestly better served bringing in younger talent and making space for younger players and players of the such, as opposed to wasting your time with a player that's going to be way too old and who knows what form he'll be in when the tournament rolls around, considering that Sunderland are pretty much guaranteed to go down this season. I mean, even if he does move on to a different team, it's going to be difficult for him to adjust considering his age and other factors. So it's an interesting decision. And even if it works out now, it's a weird decision, in my opinion.
It's a little bit, I mean, it's a hard one to look at, really, isn't it? Because when you look at what Gareth Southgate seems to be doing, seems to be moving the England squad in at least a positive direction, right?
Yeah, certainly. And I think the tactics that he played against Germany certainly reflect that. We see a departure from the 4-4-2 and a more advanced tactical concept, and players like Jake Livermore and Keane getting a look in into a more modern tactical system is something that, at this, while it, you know, makes room for the future, the inclusion of someone like Defoe is extremely weird. So it's almost like they're pulling in opposite directions.
It is unusual, Chris. Obviously, you've been watching Sunderland a lot more than a lot of other people.
It's a consequence of the fact that England isn't producing that many top strikers, though, as well. I talked to Paul McGinnis about this when I spoke to him about Rashford, and he said that, in his opinion, it is an issue for England at this precise moment that they're not producing that top-level forward that maybe, say, you had in 96, where it was the likes of Ferdinand, Sheringham and Shearer, all, I would say, in the top tier, at least domestically, if not within Europe. And then you had a decent sort of sample to pick from. So at the minute, you're maybe looking at someone that doesn't have the kind of pedigree of that player who's come through an academy and been in the Premier League their entire career. You are going to have to look a little bit more left field. So I don't think in that situation, Jamie Vardy is so much of an outlier. I think he actually starts to become a little bit of the rule, where you'll see the likes of Andre Gray, maybe even a Scott Hogan, if he can get Villa promoted, come into the national team setup and start to produce.
Within that as well, obviously, Jermaine Defoe is a great experienced player. I mean, he can bring the experience of, scoring goals from difficult situations, difficult paths, those sort of things. And I think he probably brings some experience to the squad, which maybe England are lacking right now. And the good thing for Defoe is he's not necessarily part of that generation which is tainted, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, look, this is the thing. I think he himself is aging to the point where I would say this is his peak. There was a strongly held belief that earlier in his career, he took a lot of shots. He was quite inconsistent. Maybe he was more of a scorer of great goals than a great goal scorer. Whereas now, I think with the refinement of age, he knows where he's supposed to be. He knows, I think, the game a lot better than he did, say, 10 years ago even. That's the thing you have to look at is some strikers, and I think even you could extrapolate this out into every position on the field, players mature at different ages and reach the peak of their powers at different ages. Yes, there's strong theories on 27, 28 is when a player hits their peak performance, and I think there's some truth to that. I think there will always be, as I talk about those outliers, players that don't conform to that. The likes of, say, Didier Drogba, who didn't come to prominence at the top level until fairly later in his career. Even someone like Teddy Sheringham, who we referenced there before, was still playing at a very high level until the age of 42 because his game wasn't based on being able to burst past people. It was much more of a mental game that the first 5 yards were in his head. And I think if England can build a system that caters to that kind of forward, yes, then they can start to rely on Defoe for the longer term. But the problem he's had is that whenever he's been used, it's tended to be as a lone striker with balls being pumped up to him. That really isn't going to do a great amount of stuff for him because he's not built to play that way.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because obviously that then complements other strikers who can think in the box. It also seems as if the more savvy players are thriving under... or at least more stimulated players seem to be thriving under Gareth Southgate. It's, I don't know. There's something likeable, Chris, about this England squad, and I can't quite put my finger on it.
There is. I think what it is, and Nico touched on it a little bit, it's the embrace of new ideas, I think, is what it is. It doesn't seem as if perhaps there are a multitude of egos involved. I think maybe some of the pathways these players have taken, guys like Adam Lallana, Vardy that we touched on, there's a little bit more humility in starting in League One and starting in non-league football and then working to this point. I think it makes them not just more likeable, but also, I think, more relatable as well. And that's perhaps been the problem, is that you go back to let's say, the Gary Neville era and that idea of them chairing a meeting because they didn't agree with things that were going on. That's when I think, rightly or wrongly, I can't claim to know one way or the other at this point, that's when I think players can start to look a little bit diva-ish and as if there's ego invested there more than the pure pride of representing your country. Because I imagine when Vardy was at Stocksbridge and when Lallana, to use examples, were starting in League One, playing for England very much was a dream. It was never an expectation. And I think that in turn makes everything seem a little bit more relatable to the average fan.
Absolutely. I mean, there is that element for England. Maybe it's just also the great midfield. We'll see. I think I'm quite enjoying England's midfield shape at the moment, Nick. I don't know about you, but Lallana does seem to be thriving, as does Dele Alli. And, you know, they've not even got Henderson sitting at the base of that.
Yeah, I mean, it does look good. It looks youthful to a certain extent with the inclusion of Dele Alli in there. And also one that can thrive in tournaments, because tournaments tend to pander towards teams that don't take the onus to create. And with a pressing midfield with the likes of Dele Alli and Adam Lallana in there, like you mentioned, that could be an excellent team that catches teams that take the onus to create in the latter stages of the competition. So who knows? Maybe we'll see some tournament development from England in the near future.
I guess it's also sort of worth saying that there's a lot of diverse squads out there that have won tournaments, not all about youth. And whilst it is good to develop youth, you know, it's good to have that balance out as well. There's some good things elsewhere, but bad things as well. Chris, I mean, in the Republic of Ireland game against Wales, there was a massive headline in there. And since, a lot of journalists have been on the spectrum of hysterical at times, whilst trying to pretend to be the reasonable voice.
Yeah, lots of discussion about not that type of player and essentially players' motives and intent and whether malice is involved in there. I think what you can do is isolate the situation and say it was a really reckless tackle. And it wasn't the only one. There was another one from Gareth Bale on John O'Shea that was a little bit wince-inducing. I think part of the issue here is the referee was incredibly lax during that game. He let a lot of things fly. And I think the difficulty in that situation presents itself because if you're not setting a standard, then I think inevitably players are going to start to push that because there's a lot involved here. There's not just, I would say, pride amongst the home nations and the Republic of Ireland, but also I think there's an element of we need to qualify for this competition and winning this game puts us closer to that. And I think when you're playing in a game like Republic of Ireland v Wales, you would argue a lot of the players are coming from the same domestic leagues where things are fast, it's quite open, it's quite aggressive. And all of that put together, for me, builds up to a cocktail of that kind of situation occurring. I can't claim to know if Taylor has a strong background of this, whether he actually did mean it or not. Only he's going to know whether he went in there with anything other than an intent to win the ball. I think we have to maybe look at protecting players a little bit more in those kind of situations. And while I am loath to criticise referees because of the complicated nature of their jobs, it does, I think, a slither of responsibility fall onto the referee for not setting a better standard in terms of control.
Well, Gareth Bale could have gone off for a similar challenge. Well, not a similar challenge, but a pretty dangerous challenge just moments before as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned that there as well as being another instance of a dangerous tackle. So it's such a fine balancing act as well. And you know, we've seen commentators down the years discuss this, the idea of setting a standard or potentially making your job more difficult by giving out an early yellow card, because what you're striving for across the 90 minutes is consistency of decision. And fans, players, etc., can become very irritated when they see an identical situation not receive the same punishment that maybe they or their team have been punished for. And again, that's where really a referee has to, and I think it's an incredibly difficult aspect of the job, one of many difficult aspects, approach it from quite a macro perspective and say, okay, well, if I'm judging this to be yellow card worthy, I have to accept that every decision like this moving forward, within reason, will be yellow card worthy as well.
Do you think there is a bit of an issue in that sometimes it's, you know, hindsight is 20/20. You know, it's very easy to say, well, of course, you know, of course the referee should make this decision, or, you know, of course he shouldn't have let it get to that point. But has that broken leg not happened, we might just be saying, well, there were some tasty tackles there, lol, lol, lol.
I don't think we would be. I think certainly that there's a case to be made that a section of the audience would have looked at it that way. But I think that's where instances like this have to be used as learning opportunities and not purely a situation to scold those involved, because really it's far too easy to just appropriate blame. I think you do have to try and take lessons from it. And the lesson is that as competitive as these games are, you have to be conscious of whether, even if a tackle, for argument's sake, misses by an inch, a foot, whatever, that with a few more stars aligning, it could end up in the same way that Seamus Coleman's unfortunate tackle did with him breaking his leg.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it's sad, but it is what it is. Elsewhere, Nico, what's going on with Spain? Finally moving on, it seems, from that golden generation.
Yeah, certainly. If I can just say one thing about that, the challenge on Coleman, though.
Sorry,
I think
you're not British. You wouldn't know.
And Nipun has mentioned this on my podcast as well, is that I think we need to get away from this idea of intent on a challenge, which is that, like, you know, these players are flying in. If we sort of set the standard that they shouldn't be, the game, how it moves so quick in the modern age and all these things, like, we need to create a different sort of standard for the type of challenges that players should be going in for in the first place, because the primary objective is player safety, right?
But at the same time, it sort of isn't safety a subjective thing?
No, not really, because if challenges like that and specifically head challenge or challenges that deal with the head and things like the likes of the challenge that saw Fernando Torres get knocked out, you know, a lot of people say come away from that challenge and say completely accidental, nothing you could do about that. But the reality of the situation is that that player was coming in a dangerous situation. While they may have completely intended to play the ball,
I don't think that is dangerous. I just think it's really unfortunate that Fernando Torres got hit in just the place which knocked him out. I didn't agree with that. I didn't think it was a dangerous way to tackle someone. And what are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to do with a long ball game then? Like, you know, you can't play the long ball game because you're going to have your striker sent off.
Well, no, I disagree. Cause I think two people can go up for a header without taking a 5-yard run up and getting up to full speed and then running into somebody else.
Yeah. But we both know that's not that's changing the game on a really fundamental level.
Well, we'll agree to disagree on that one
but that's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering how that does fundamentally change the game. I'm putting this point to you, you know, if mm-hmm. that does fundamentally change the way that you can hit a long ball up, if Joe Hart is a certain way or someone is a certain way, then what happens?
I'm not exactly sure. Maybe the fundamentals of the game do need to be changed because we do need to deal with head injuries in a different way, because we've seen players in the past suffer long-term effects from them continuing to play through a concussion.
How many other players have we seen knocked out in the way that Fernando Torres was knocked out?
Not that many, but if we can avoid that situation altogether, is that the worst thing in the world?
Okay. This is what I'm wondering Chris, with the Fernando Torres, you remember when Fernando Torres got knocked out? I mean, I'm sort of with Nipun on this one. I'm questioning how you sort of implement a rule for safety with players which will end up very fundamentally changing the way that the game works. If Kristen's even still there.
I think Nipun and Nico make some fair points. The difficulty is you're potentially going to come up against players who make a living off those kind of tackles. Not dangerous tackles per se, but more risky tackles. And I think one of the appeals of football is the contact nature of it and the fact that you can go to ground for a tackle. There are certainly instances where I think that, yes, the notion of removing intent is important because it can almost mitigate a tackle when it shouldn't. But I do also think there are unfortunate instances where a player is not intending to cause injury. I remember many years ago, Nani got sent off for Man United against Real Madrid. I don't think his intent was to leave six studs on his opponent. It was just a case of that he was watching the ball, not what was around him, and that was an accident. So I think accidents can occur, and I'm concerned slightly that by removing intent entirely, you do then open up the chance to essentially, you know, deem a lot of players guilty when they're maybe not.
Interesting point. Elsewhere, USA, guys, is looking good.
Are we going to do Spain?
Oh, fine. Yeah, let's do Spain then. Okay. Spain, go on.
Yeah, no. Spain's moving. Finally, the changing of the guard is coming to fruition from a golden generation to another great generation. But one thing I'd like to point out is the under-21 squad looking absolutely amazing with the likes of Marco Asensio, Iñaki Williams, Denis Suarez, Sal Niguez, Yeray Bellerin. These are all guys that are, you know, we're talking about competitively at the highest level of football, and they're still in the under-21 squad for the Spanish national team. So in terms of prospects, it's absolutely incredible. So definitely looking forward to the future for the Spanish national team.
I like that. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the progress as well of the U.S. men's national team?
Sorry, you cut off there.
Tell me about the progress as well of the U.S. men's national team.
Yeah, I think if there's one thing I'd like to highlight in terms of the United States, being an American myself, I think there's a big distinction that we need to make for the likes of Christian Pulisic, which to many, and this is my opinion as well, is that he's, you know, the most talented American that we're going to see for a while. And he certainly is right now. And I think there's a large portion of Americans that aren't day-to-day soccer or football fans. And so when the international break comes around and they become extraordinarily passionate about the U.S. men's national team, as they should, then there's all this hope and there's all this hype and there's all this expectation lumped upon a young kid to make a huge impression. If he doesn't do that, or if in their eyes he doesn't do that, you know, we're dealing with a situation that I think is common in your soccer or football culture, which is to hype up these young individuals and make their lives essentially miserable if they don't exceed the expectations that they've been given by the demanding public.
Interesting. I mean, Chris, what do you see with Pulisic? I mean, it's been a good, it's been an improvement for the USA from what they considered a low with Klinsmann.
It has. I think they had a lot of positive factors go into that victory. The fact that a lot of the players knew what they were doing. The defence was there to defend. The attack was there to create. I think as simple as that sounds, it made a massive difference because it gave everyone confidence. There was no uncertainty in individuals, which meant collectively there was a lot more confidence across the board. I think, you know, it's interesting how you dissect this game from a standpoint of Pulisic, because before the game, people were talking about him and Landon Donovan and the fact that if he wanted to match Donovan, he needed to come up big in these games because these are the crunch games. The thing I think really helped him just from a playing perspective was Honduras in relation to CONCACAF are not the greatest team. And I think a lot of people, after that first 5-10 minutes when they went up early on, realised that the US were going to dominate the ball and they were going to really have a bit of a free run and attack on that defence. And so what that meant for Pulisic was whenever he made a mistake, chances are he was going to get the ball within 2-3 minutes and get another go at it. Now, where I think he deserves credit is that he always wanted the ball. There was a few things that maybe didn't go his way and a few times where he lost the ball. And I think it would have been very easy for him to climb inside himself and very much sort of get on his own back. But the fact that, again, he wanted the ball, he wanted to keep trying to do things and try and create things, that's a positive sign in terms of his future projections because it suggests he's got the shoulders and the mentality to achieve that top level. But I also think the important caveat with that is the game was very much set up so that the likes of him, the likes of Dempsey, Leger until he went off, could attack. It at times, to me at least, felt a little bit like attack v defence training session. And I think put him in a game against someone where maybe the standards are a little bit closer, then I would like to see how he handles losing the ball 2 or 3 times in a row. Does he still kind of want it? Does he still try the things that I think are getting US fans so excited? Or does he maybe play with a little bit more caution and just start to keep the ball a bit more?
It's an interesting debate, isn't it, over in American football or football in America or American soccer. Works well. Now, what about the country where he's playing his trade, Nico? Germany. Some people saying that they look more vulnerable than they did before under a system which seemed to peak just maybe at the World Cup and then sort of continue to live off maybe a reputation for a little longer.
Yeah, I think it can be difficult to make that transition from, you know, World Cup champions, and they did all right in the Euros. But sort of fitting in those new players as you see out the old ones can obviously be a difficult transition. But when I was watching England versus Germany, although it was a friendly and basically Lukas Podolski shot the ball every time he got it, there was still England did very well in the first half. They didn't let a shot on target come through. And so as many times as Germany looked good in attack, they looked vulnerable in defense, in the sense that Mats Hummels, if you've seen how they've exploited him before at Borussia Dortmund, pulling him out wide, that 3-4-3 system that Germany played in the game that they'll probably continue to use going forward, considering the shift in tactics towards that system, is one that maybe doesn't suit the German defenders. And, you know, bringing in that new generation, that Julian Brandt, that Timo Werner, can be somewhat difficult because you do have to change your tactics a little bit in bringing in those players, because Timo Werner had an awful game. And that's not because he's a bad player, but because he plays in a different system at Leipzig.
Tell me a little bit about what you think I mean, because the problem is a lot of people sort of hold up the the model of whatever a player is playing at their club as the ideal model to play them in, because that's obviously the model that got them into the national team, right? But there are probably other ways to get the best out of that player.
Yeah, certainly. But I think the traditional way in which Germany want to play and have played the past few tournaments, which is, you know, a little bit of possession football as well as some good counterattacking styles, is probably not the best way to do that. It's more sitting off the ball and being a pressing team, something that has been consistent with the type of system that Timo Werner and his compatriots have frequented in their home clubs.
So what's the goal here?
I think the goal for and his name is escaping me, the manager of the German national team, is to transition Joachim Löw, is to transition the system to one that fits the players that are going to make the impact. So perhaps transitioning to a better pressing system and not being so reliant on the likes of Toni Kroos and those players that have brought him success in the past is key to bringing the new generation of Germans forward into the World Cup.
Okay, fair enough. Let's talk a little bit about Holland, Chris, because there's some pretty, how can I put it? It's not great.
It's really not. Danny Blind has been sacked as head coach. He opted to start Matthijs de Ligt, 17-year-old Ajax centre-back, which, you know, we talk about Pulisic is interesting. I've seen a little bit of De Ligt this season. He is very talented, and I think there will come a day where he is a regular member of the Dutch national team. I don't think this was the point for him to make his debut, because he's made, I think, no more than two starts or two appearances in the league this season for Ajax. So it was a bizarre one, and I think, look, there's issues outside of Blind. I don't think he is the be-all and end-all. I think it's far too easy to scapegoat him like that. I think you can look at the fact that there's really not a wealth of talented young Dutch coaches at the minute. You know, Philip Cocu maybe looked good a year or two ago. There's really not, I would say, anyone outside of him that's pushing themselves forward. And equally, look, they are also still relying on the likes of Wesley Sneijder, who is well into his 30s. So it's a shame, because, again, we look at Holland across history as being real pioneers for the sport, and Cruyff, Rinus Michels, you can very much reel off the key influences in football and how they shape not just Dutch football, but, you know, the entire game globally. I think, as with any point, though, you will have a peak, you will also have a valley. It's how they respond to this now is the most important thing, because it increasingly looks like they'll miss out on the World Cup. They also obviously missed out on the Euros in 2016, and I don't think, you know, that there isn't, I don't think they are bereft of talent. You look at guys like maybe Justin Kluivert, who could come in, who is perhaps in a better position than De Ligt, because first and foremost he's a winger, so I would say it's easier to incorporate a winger into your side than a centre back as it stands. And also players like Depay and Wijnaldum, these are the guys that need to be stepping up. I think the question is perhaps is whether they have the character and the mentality to do so.
Yeah, it is part of the problem. Almost seems to be part of the Dutch mentality is that there's almost an assumed mentality, which if that's not conformed to, or that's broken in some way, then it seems to.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Crumble the whole system. It's almost as if it's all or nothing for Holland.
I mean, the thing is, as long as I've been watching football, there's always been a perception that the Dutch aren't united, which is quite ironic when you consider that they pioneered total football. You look at, and the story that always jumps out to me is Schneider at the World Cup with the third choice goalkeeper, Pete Valusian, making fun of the fact that he earns 10 times more than him. That for me is not what you really want from your national team, because, you know, as we've seen with lesser nations at the Euros last summer, and then also a little bit in this qualifying, the likes of Iceland can achieve a lot when they unite and operate with a slightly more holistic approach to their team. I think it would, again, though, be unfair to simply say that, oh, it's individualism that's killing the Dutch national team at this point. There is a talent issue as well. Undeniably, there is a talent issue. You look at perhaps the best striker that they've got, Vincent Janssen, isn't getting a kick at Tottenham. There's, I think, a poorly... The thing is with this, realistically, to be successful at international level, you have to hope that the generations overlap fairly seamlessly. You have to hope that as the Van Persies and Huntelaars retire, there is someone to fill that void. And I think that's the problem with Holland now, is they're in a very transitional phase as a national team, both on the field and off it. And the cold hard truth is there's just not those bodies or those talents to fill in the voids that are being left behind.
Elsewhere, there's some exciting times for the bodies and the voids of Italy, Nico. Obviously, Buffon played his 1,000th game. Not for Italy on its own, but his 1,000th game as a goalkeeper. There was much hooting and hollering over that one. But the excitement seems to come for Buffon, because it seems like they have a ready-made successor for him, as they also seem to have found a number of positions on the pitch, which make them an almost dark horse for the next tournament.
Yeah, an almost dark horse, and it depends really where Ventura decides to take this squad. He obviously has talented youngsters in the likes of Lorenzo Insigne and Marco Verratti to make the best of, and it's within those players that didn't have the ability or couldn't make the impact that they wanted to at Euro 2016 that we see this team, you know, going into the future and hopefully making the best of what is almost a golden Italian generation.
And there are certain figures within that generation which just look fantastic, aren't they?
Yeah, like Donnarumma. I mean, you can't ask for a better replacement than for Gianluigi Buffon than Donnarumma, someone that has excelled from a very young age. And it's within those players and the combination of the young players that I mentioned, as well as the experience of someone like a Bonucci, a Chiellini, and those figures that have provided such consistency over the years, both in Italian football and in the national team, that really, like you said, make Italy a solid contender for the next international competition. So look out for them in 2018.
Elsewhere, Chris, it seems like it's a bit of a weird sort of amalgam of the two for Belgium at the moment, because they find themselves with that golden generation, or at least almost coming to the next golden generation that they find themselves in, and then drawing last minute against Belgium.
The thing is for Belgium, the players are very good. It's just the coaches that have been in charge that don't seem to be right. I mean, I saw Mark Wilmots described as the Belgian Harry Redknapp. I don't think that's a terribly unfair portrait to construct, because really he is very heavily influenced by what he can do motivationally rather than here's the plan, this is how we're going to do it. I would say that Martinez represents a shift from that, but I would argue perhaps overcorrecting, in so much as he's too far the other way in terms of he's desperate for this very detailed ideology, but he doesn't acknowledge the fact that actually it doesn't maybe work with what he's doing. He's not, for me, Martinez is not a very pragmatic coach. He has his idea on how he wants football to be played, but I don't think he allows for the fact that you don't see international squads and players very often. So ideally you need something that either they're playing with week in, week out at their club team, which is what we saw, I think, with Spain when they won World Cups and European Championships. The players were very aware of how to play because they were doing it week in, week out anyway. Or you need something that actually works with the group at hand. And I just think his style simply doesn't do that.
Which sort of begs the question as to why they originally brought him in.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I can't claim to be in the heads of the Belgian FA. If I was, I would be a better man for it, I imagine. I imagine realistically, though, it goes back to what I said about the overcorrection. It's the idea that, okay, we had someone that was perhaps very motivational and could inspire, but there wasn't a great plan to carry us through those moments where we had an opponent that was on our level, if not better. So they've tried to get someone that they believe can construct a plan that will get them past those better opposition, and then in theory be so astute that it will also help them in the moments where maybe they need to kick up the backside.
But with Martinez, do you really get that preparation? Because as we saw as his closing days at Everton, I mean, I think everybody was questioning his tactics.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder in many ways, because the thing with Everton and Martinez was his ideology was very clear, but it goes back to that lack of pragmatism. He didn't acknowledge for the fact that his defenders weren't elite level defenders, so they couldn't play out from the back all the time, and that actually operating with the style that he did left them with a distinct lack of coverage. And so he was so focused on, we have to play, we have to pass, etc., etc. It didn't account for, hang on, there's going to be periods where we don't have the ball, and how do we protect ourselves, or how do we win the ball back? I'm not saying it's the most detailed approach, but I think he maybe, in the interview process or whatever, was able to convey the belief that his approach was detailed. And I think, look, at that point, you know, I can't help you, because if you think he's heard the right
slide PowerPoint.
Yeah, I mean, look, that, you know, that's part of it. Is that, again, if he said to them, you know, the players you have are better than the ones I had at Everton, it's very easy to be convinced in these things. You know, we've all seen coaches and players get jobs that we didn't think they were deserving for. I don't want to throw Martinez under the bus and say that's what this is here, as much as I can certainly see a scenario where the Belgian FA are convinced by a good interview or a good presentation that he's put together.
Yeah, the Premier League's a hard league. We all know that in Europe. Give me the job. You've got it. It's fantastic. You managed to navigate Everton to a consistent eighth place. And funnily enough, that's where Belgium may end up in the world rankings. Weirdly, though, Nico, if you look at the last gasp of winners that Lukaku has afforded both of his sides very recently, most of his recent goals have come very late.
Yeah, he's consistently saving the day for his various teams. He's an excellent player, and he'll continue to do that both at international level and club level. But I think, you know, what Chris was touching on was that, you know, it's an interesting decision that the Belgian FA have gone in terms of their coaching decisions. And I think there's a possible question that they're wasting their best talent pool ever. I mean, you look at some of the players that they have, just the first ones that come to mind: Kevin De Bruyne, Dries Mertens, Jan Vertonghen, Eden Hazard. I mean, these guys are excellent players, and you're leaving them in the hands of Roberto Martinez and, previous to that, Mark Wilmots. I mean, this is possibly the greatest wasted generation of talent that is that first comes to mind.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Well, is that a little unfair?
How is that unfair?
I mean, it's a country historically in recent years that hasn't been the case. Is sort of building towards something. Feels like that tap of talent hasn't really turned off.
Yeah, but you can certainly make the case that they should have performed a little bit better in Euro 2016 with the
yeah,
you're right.
Maybe I'm thinking of talent in the wrong way. I mean, those players still didn't win anything in that time, and they, you know. Steven Gerrard, if England win the next World Cup, which they won't, but if they did, is not going to look back and sort of go, well, I was part of that phylum of players that ultimately led to the World Cup. You know, he wasn't in the 23, which is weird, really, because, you know, could you make the argument that every generation of players building up to a World Cup should get a at least a mention in that?
Every generation of players?
Well, I mean, you know, if England won the World Cup, I'm sure that there would be, I suppose most journalist articles do sort of.
What do you think England's chances truly are of winning the World Cup in 2018?
I think they're very slim because the system, I mean, they're slim to not great, right? But I mean, the point would be.
But why? Because for me, I think if you look at the players individually, you have Kyle Walker and Danny Rose, which is probably one of the best.
Know that's not the issue here.
Isn't the England idea and more recently the England squads another case for wasted potential? Because you've had fantastic players and you still have fantastic players. You know, Raheem Sterling, Dele Alli are fantastic players. Jordan Henderson's a really solid player. John Stones is a really good center back. All these players are really good individually, and yet we've consistently seen failure from England.
I mean, there's not really an argument against that. It's sort of like making an argument for it and against it. You're not really getting. That's almost not the point. We're sort of at a point now where we need to. I feel like our Southgate's probably going in a good direction.
Okay.
Or at least in the right direction. I mean, I think he's doing the right thing by employing what most of those players in the clubs will be more familiar with than maybe the conservatism with the small c of what Roy Hodgson was employing.
I'll pose this question to you and Chris. Do you think the lack of diversity within the squad is something that has held England back for the past few years, considering that recently in the squad and not just the recent friendlies, but previous to that, you know, only one, if not none of the players have played abroad in other systems and in other leagues?
I mean, I think it's probably good and bad, but then you could also argue that, I mean, surely during those generations when England claimed to have the best managers and the best systems in Europe, because they had Mourinho, Benitez, Ferguson, Wenger, I put Benitez ahead of Ferguson, but you know what I mean? They had continental managers. You know, there's very little argument as to why going abroad now is, no, maybe that's not true because an education really makes a huge difference. I mean, I was interested to find out that Stoke City have an academy, and I mean like a permanent fixture of an academy in Shanghai. Manchester United don't. Man City don't. But Stoke City do.
Chris, do you have thoughts on the lack of diversity?
I think the lack of diversity is an argument presented when it suits a narrative. So in 2006, Italy's squad had next to no diversity in relation to all of their players were based within Serie A. You look at Spain's dominance, very few, I think if any of the starters at least, were based outside of Spain. I know a few of the depth players were.
If I can just touch to the Spain thing, I think there's like an asterisk next to that in the sense that Spain went with a unconventional approach to that tournament of football because they sought to play that possession football that almost requires players to consistently play together to understand where they're going to be on the pitch and have that fluidity and chemistry that was so consistent with the Spanish national team. But I understand what you're saying.
I think as well, and I've been just reading up on this, so it's fairly timely. Marcello Lippi said of the squad that he took in 2006 that he didn't think it was the best 23 players in Italy. He thought it was the best team to win the competition. Right. And I think if you're looking for an explainer, and again, there is no one issue with England as there isn't with Holland or Belgium or whatever, you could form a very good case that England has rarely, if ever, picked on form relative to the squad. There's been too much favouritism. And look, you could extrapolate that and apply it to the US as well. I think one of the reasons that they performed so well against Honduras was the fact there was no more favouritism. Everyone, for the most part, had to earn their place back in the squad. And Bruce Arena was willing to give players, he's called Paul Arriola in this week after a few injuries, he's willing to give fresh faces a chance. And the thing is that when it comes to to, you know, the footballing culture and a lack of diversity there. I would like to see more English players play abroad because I think, yes, it does improve them and it will improve their, I think, understanding of the game more than anything. But I think you don't have to do that to win a tournament. I think you can look at it from a slightly different vantage point and say it would improve the quality of British coaches, definitely. And it may even improve the quality of future generations because you would learn things while you were a player that you may apply into your coaching. But as it stands right now, I think as long as you don't pick the best squad stroke team for the tournament, you're always doing yourself a greater disservice than you are just by staying at home.
Go ahead, Nico. You can reply to that.
I completely agree with a lot of what Chris is saying. So I don't have much to say outside of that. But I think one thing that I fail to hear when I hear the analysis of tournaments and when people speak of tournaments in general is this idea of what people or what a team needs to win a tournament. And I think that isn't addressed enough. And I think we take the very small sample size that we get of national team performances, which is realistically qualifiers and tournaments, as the end all be all of those players' performances at the national team, when there's so much luck since it is such a small sample size in winning a tournament. And so that's really the only thing I would add to that.
Yeah, good point. Now, Chris, over in the States, there have been some big games, and you had the luck of attending one of the biggest.
I was at New York Red Bulls against Real Salt Lake.
Sorry, I was talking about hashtag United.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, yes.
No, we'll talk about that in a minute, but it was a seamless transition.
That was good. No, yes, I did attend that on Saturday morning over in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Keep going. Go on. I mean, you can't.
I'm allowed to say anymore.
Give us the result. You can tell us. Well, there's very little you can tell. I mean, you saw what you saw.
It was
Jimmy's
a good game.
Right.
It was a well contested game. I think, from a hashtag perspective, it was a very good challenge because there were some notable names in there. At least from an American perspective, Stephen Keel, who played in Major League Soccer, Aleko Eskandarian, obviously Jimmy himself, James Riley, a much lesser known MLS player, dropped in, and there was a few on Jimmy's team, I think, that you could tell had some sort of professional background. Maybe didn't make it to senior teams, but at least had played in the game in some decent standards. So from that end, I think it was possibly the toughest test that hashtag have maybe had, and I'm sure Spencer and those will speak better to that. But I thought, you know what, I thought they showed themselves well for a team that has travelled the States, has had to maybe adjust to differing situations, different climates. I thought they handled that well. And I can also see from their perspective why they've won so many games, because they are very communicative. They're very well organised, actually, and they do seek to help each other out and are very much a team. That there's very little individualism in that side, and I think that's very admirable.
We'll find out in a few weeks' time what happened there. Now, Chris, MLS update.
Yes, as I alluded to there before, I was at Red Bull Arena quite literally after I finished watching hashtag. And there was a Liverpool youngster on show, Brooks Lennon, who was on loan from Liverpool to Real Salt Lake, the team that he started at. And then also, I thought, Tyler Adams for New York Red Bulls. For me, it wasn't the greatest game. It finished 0-0. There were some poorly missed chances. But I thought Adams equipped himself very well, had the most touches, best pass completion. And for someone who's only 18, I think you're looking at a player that has not only a lot of potential, but I would go as far to say if he keeps improving the way that I've seen him so far, will likely play in Europe at some stage in his career.
Interesting stuff. Miko, have you been watching any MLS over the last few days?
Unfortunately, I have not. I was away.
What the hell?
I was at the beach.
What was the beach like?
Beach is good. Florida, where I live, has got some. We have a wealth of beaches with a lot of sharks too, but got some good beaches.
You have some sharks?
Yeah, New Smyrna, which is the beach that I frequent, is the shark attack, or was the shark attack capital of the world. Still up there in the ranking. So,
gentlemen, on that, I'm going to have to depart.
Fair enough. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us. If people want to go find you, they can go to Khenage, Khenage, correct?
That is correct.
Good. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
I will see you soon. Bye.
Chris, great guy there. Nico, finish off with me here. Let's go to a bit of domestic football. In between, however, what I have just seen on Skype is Gareth Southgate saying he wanted Wilfried Zaha, but he was too late.
He was too late in what sense? Well, Zaha plays now for Cote d'Ivoire, right? Ivory Coast.
Yeah.
Which is a fantastic African team, which I think all better to him because African teams, you know, he can be part of the transition to that next golden generation. You know, they're leaving the likes of Didier Drogba and Yaya Toure and Kolo Toure and some of those players. So Zaha could possibly lead the next evolution of the Ivory Coast and the talented players that they produce. So I think Zaha is one of those players that I was recently listening to a story that because Zaha did play in the youth, the England youth setup, and I heard that him and Raheem Sterling would go back and forth in practice and see how many defenders they could just absolutely skin in practice. So definitely a talented player and maybe one that Southgate saw usage in.
What's going on with Roma? You got a little update on Roma for us.
Yeah, Monchi, which is the transfer director for Sevilla, is reportedly, allegedly moving to Roma, which is a fantastic move because he obviously made a lot with a little for Sevilla in a few years there. And I think they thrived as much as they could in sort of being the exterior team in Spain in terms of not being a Real Madrid or Barcelona. And I think the move to Roma, which has historically been a big club, but perhaps not in recent years, not achieved the success that its history has you know, provided the standard for.
It's history or its city or its geography, yeah.
Right. Provided the standard for, you know, someone like Monchi moving over there is an excellent move for that club. And I think they can do some fantastic things with him at the helm, because I think that's really where you see football clubs either excel or, you know, dig themselves into a deep, deep hole. I was looking at some information and data today regarding, you know, I wanted to see the consistencies between some of the best European teams and how many players and how long they keep them. And It's no surprise to find out that the majority of the top European teams like Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, Barcelona have a core of players that have been there for 5 years or more, and teams that, you know, have a little bit of wayward success here and there don't have, you know, consistency within their squads and consistency within their top players. So hopefully if Roma can achieve that to some extent, then they'll be back amongst the European elite.
I mean, surely it's not just about having a player at a club for 5 years.
No. It's not about having one player at a club. It's about having a core of players and not really turning over the whole squad every time you bring in a different manager. And I think that's where some English clubs tend to falter, is that they don't have a director of football or a sporting director to manage the or mitigate the risk when you bring in a coach with a completely different ideology.
That's a very good point, actually. Yeah, because you can go on these 3-year cycles, but if you don't have any consistency throughout those cycles or a plan for the way those cycles will function, then maybe you are in trouble.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Nico, where can people go find your shit?
My shit? Yeah. My toilet. But if you want to find my work...
How safe is your shit?
How safe is it?
Yeah.
I mean, it looks to be a good color. It doesn't float, so it's a
wow.
It's good fat content. Okay,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Is that a factor?
I think, yeah, if your shit is not supposed to float, it's supposed to sink. Because if it floats, then you have too high of a fat content in your diet.
Wow. I didn't know that, but now I do.
You didn't know? Does your shit float?
I'll be completely honest. I don't actually look.
You don't look?
No.
You go to the bathroom and you flush and you don't look?
Yeah.
That's absurd. You're a madman.
Let us know. Is it absurd? Is it absurd not to not to take the satisfaction? I mean, I get what the satisfaction is of looking.
No,
at
No, it's
what
not
you
a satisfaction
produced.
Thing. It's
no,
a,
I understand
it's
your fetish completely, but you know, the point is
it's a health thing.
Is it?
Yeah, because I mean, you got to make sure it's a good color. You know, all these factors.
Interesting. I didn't realize. Maybe I just have other things on my mind, but maybe from now on I will look.
Yeah. Hey, look.
What we want you to know is on TF3 we want all of you to maintain a healthy anus.
Yeah.
In many ways, this is where the hashtag I am the hole becomes so relevant.
That was its true meaning. I mean, I think you guys have gone off the rails a little bit since then, but I think the true original meaning of I am the hole is within the anus.
Yeah, and then obviously TF3, the front three, meaning the front three wipes, because you're only supposed to wipe your backside three times after you've gone to the toilet.
Right, pretty much, yeah.
No. Again, Nico, if you're health obsessed and if you're relying on your shit to tell you if you're healthy or not, then you'll know it's three wipes.
Yeah, completely agree.
Well, this took a weird turn, but I feel like it ended strong. Hey,
listen, we didn't start out so good, but we ended strong. I think that's what's important.
You
to
know
the people.
What? Sometimes good shit is like that, I'm told. Anyway, we will come. The problem, yeah, maybe that's why we're so low down in the iTunes charts. We don't have enough fat content in the podcast.
We're not floating.
Yeah, so. Basically, yeah. Anyway, it's been great to have you, Nico. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. If people want to find my work, they can go over to @LozCast, LozCast.
Good. And if you want to find my work, you can head over to Nico Morales. I don't really know. I don't know what your at is because I don't.
It's Nico @NICO_O_Morales on Twitter.
You know, there's not a day goes by where if I need to at you, I will have to go and go on the search function and find where you are.
You never at me. You're never on Twitter.
Maybe I'm not looking for your at for that reason. Yeah. Anyway, it's been good to have you guys. Let us know on iTunes what you think of the podcast. If you've not already reviewed it, please do head over there and do that. Head over to YouTube and drop it a subscribe, because there is lots of good stuff on there and lots more good stuff to come out. Go follow Statman Dave for his daily podcast. It's a fantastic daily stats podcast, stats-based podcast. It'd be weird if you just did numbers. And we will see you again real soon right here on TF3.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.